Session number 26951.
Unreal 4. So overall, there was quite a wide variety of men, variety of backgrounds.
I think that the only way I can describe this is to say that as you just said, a variety of people that came from all walks of life, people doing different jobs. It's just a cross section of the people who lived in Sunderland at the time. As I said before, that the majority of the regiment were Sunderland men, and it was just a cross section of people. As far as the officers were concerned, the majority again were local men. There were some regular officers drafted into our regiment. Obviously, I mean, we couldn't be all learning at the job. We had to have some people who could teach us what was going on. But generally speaking, I can't really explain exactly what type of men there were there. It was just a cross section of the people who lived in Sunderland.
What about your relationship with your officers and NCOs?
Oh, very, very good. Very good. There was obviously some men who thought that some officers, or one or two officers, might be a little bit officious, but generally speaking, we got on very, very well with our officers indeed. There was never any disruption or large disagreements between officers and men. I can only liken it perhaps to, say, trade unions and employers. The relationship between officers and men were much, much better. There was no disagreement. I can't ever remember any insubordination. And that was the main thing about it. There's no insubordination. Everybody got on very well together. Well, you had to, because if you had no respect for your officers, how did you form a unit?
Was there any instances of bullying?
No.
With officers, NCOs?
No.
And the men?
No. Not that I'm aware of.
It was a good relationship between
absolutely.
The two.
Absolutely, yeah.
What about the existence of unit identity and loyalty to the unit, to the regiment?
I don't quite understand your question. Loyalty was something that that was there. It was just there. It didn't build up. Loyalty was there when you signed on to join the regiment. You were loyal to the regiment. You were loyal to your king and country. You were loyal to the whole aspect of the war. I just can't really explain what you mean by loyalty. Loyalty to me is something that's just happens. It's there.
So moving on, we started to talk about your embarkation and the ship that you sailed on.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that?
Memory details. See, you're asking me detailed questions, which quite frankly, a lot of the detail you can't remember. It's a matter of the fact that we went away from Mouth, we got on the ship, and we sailed across the Atlantic. What happened during that time in detail, I just have no recollection at all. We went to Halifax, Nova Scotia. We docked and got off the ship, and it was, as I remember, it was night time. But we didn't go into any digs or barracks or anything like that. We just moved across from one dock to another, off the English ship, the Oronce, and on to an American ship called the John T. Dickman. America were not in the war at that time, and yet they were transporting English soldiers. We sailed very quickly. I don't know whether it was the next day or the day after or what, but we sailed, and we sailed down the east coast of America and to Trinidad. We didn't get off the boat at Trinidad. We just stayed on board, and I don't know why we stayed in Trinidad, quite frankly. I suppose there was refueling and there was getting food aboard and this sort of thing. But we had no idea the reason why we were in Trinidad. I mean, Trinidad was far, far away from the war. However, we set sail again, and we went back across the Atlantic, the Southern Atlantic, to Cape Town. Cape Town was absolutely fantastic. We were allowed ashore, and the people of Cape Town were absolutely magnificent. Myself and my friend Derek Ward, who I think, if I haven't already mentioned, I don't know if I've already mentioned him on the previous tape, but never mind. This chap Derek Ward and I, we went off the boat, and there was a couple and two of their children who invited us to go with them, and they would take us in hand for that day. And we went on a tour of Cape Town. We went to their house and had we were fed. I had a meal with them. We had a thoroughly good time with that family. They were very, very generous. This was happening to everybody who got off that ship. I can't stress how good the population of Cape Town were. They all had cars, and they just took us and gave us a good time. I can't remember how long we stayed there. I think I had perhaps two or three spells of shore leave. But eventually, we set sail again, and in a convoy, and we sailed up the east coast of Africa. And it was, we all thought that we were going to the Middle East. And then we found that our ship, and perhaps a couple of others, I'm not quite sure how many, but we went due east while the rest of the convoy was sailing north. And we had no idea where we were going to until eventually we landed in Bombay. Why Bombay again? I don't know. You know, there was no war going on in Bombay, in India. However, we got off the ship, and we went, were transported to a town called Ahmednagar. And this had been an army base at one time. And we stayed there, difficult to remember again, 2-3 weeks maybe, I'm not quite sure.
Do you remember much about the stay there?
Not really. It's what I do remember about India was the poverty. While we were in Bombay, incidentally, again, the poverty in India. People lying in the streets, sleeping in the streets. It was really, it was a shock to the system to see people like that. Back to Ahmednagar, we did some manoeuvres under tropical conditions. And Well, I think I can't remember too much about it really. Oh, little anecdote. I'd been made up to land sergeant before I left England, and we went to sergeant's mess for our first meal in the evening, and we had to. It was the custom certainly in India to hang your hat on a peg outside. He went into the mess and sat down, and the first thing I noticed was very large jugs of water on the tables. They were long tables, large jugs of water. And I had no idea what these were. And then we were told that. I said, I wonder what's for dinner at night. And somebody said, oh, it'll be a curry. It wasn't very long before I realised the significance of the jugs of water. I hadn't had or tasted very much curry before that, but I can assure you it made my scalp tingle. It was really, really hot, and the jugs of water helped cool it down. But as far as the regiment were concerned, as I say, we carried out some manoeuvres under tropical conditions, and we thought perhaps that we were going back to the Middle East. I don't know why we might have thought. I thought that, but I thought we might be, because why be in India? We then went back to Bombay, and we were going to board a ship called the Empress of Asia. This ship had been a 1914-1918 ship, and it was absolutely filthy. So much so that our commanding officer refused to take us on board. The place was alive with cockroaches, and it really was an absolute disgrace to ship soldiers ask soldiers to go on board. I know that we didn't expect luxury. You never do. You don't expect luxury, but you do expect a certain standard. And this place, this ship was filthy. Anyway, we had to go. We had to go on board. Our commanding officer got a direct order, and we had to go on board. It was a coal-burning ship, and we were on convoy, and we were sailing. We sailed east again. Now, once we realised it was sailing east, it was pretty obvious that we were going to go to the Far East. Whereabouts in the Far East, of course, we had no idea. As we got near to the Malay Peninsula, we realised that we were going to go to Singapore. A few days, again, I can't specifically tell you exactly what days, but a few days before we arrived, or before we saw Singapore, there were some aeroplanes came across, and they were Japanese, and they bombed our ship. Fortunately, they missed us. And I don't know whether they made any direct hits on any other ships in the convoy. But the significant thing about that particular incident was the fact that, being a coal burner, you had to have people stoking the fires. And these were men from Liverpool. Now, I've already mentioned about Liverpool fighting, so you might gather from this that I haven't a very good impression of Liverpool people, but that's entirely wrong. Obviously, there are certain people anywhere who are not representative of their area, but these were Liverpool men, and I understand, I'm not quite sure, perhaps I I'm going to say what I think, but I don't know whether. I think they were Liverpool Irish. Now here again, this is no disrespect to the Irish, but they came out of the the Stoke Hall, and the ship just stopped. You know, it's because there was nobody feeding the boilers and the furnaces to keep steam going. Eventually they went back, and it was pretty obvious that if that happened again, the same thing was going to happen. So that our commanding officer, with the permission of the captain of the ship, asked for volunteers in case this happened again.
So this happened when the ship was attacked?
That's right. Well, as soon as it was attacked, they came out. Again, it might have been a day or two after, we were very near Singapore, we could see Singapore, and more planes came across. And again, these Stokers came out of the Stoke Hall, and our chaps went down to keep the fires going, keep the steam up so we could progress and zigzag or do whatever manoeuvres they thought was necessary to avoid the bombs that were coming from the aircraft. At this time we were hit. I don't know how far we were off Singapore in terms of distance, but we could see Singapore, and it was reasonably close. We were hit, and amidships, and this is where we had our first war casualties. I know we lost some men that I've told you about in Liverpool, but this was really our first war casualties. Just a few of our officers. I can't speak for any other regiments, but there was two or three of our officers were killed. And the bombs hit, as I say, amidships, so that it split the ship in two. When I say split the ship in two, I didn't mean physically it split the ship in two. At the front of the ship, there was one lot of blokes, and at the back end, there was another. We had no contact in between. The people who were, I think we better use Seaman's words, the people who were aft, they were very fortunate because there was a naval boat came out, and they were literally could step from one boat to another. We who were the fortunate ones who were forward couldn't do that. And incidentally, we were all down in our bunk areas, and when we were told to abandon ship, I clearly remember coming up the steps, and the bulkhead of the ship was just one massive flame. Made our way to the front of the ship, and just waited for orders until eventually we were told to abandon ship. Nothing to walk onto. You just had to go down ropes. If there were some ropes, you went down ropes, or you just jumped off. Funny thing. I was about four rows back from the rail, and as blokes were going down these ropes and jumping off, you moved forward until it came to your turn. And all of this was done quite calmly. There was no panic or anything like that. In fact, blokes were joking about going for a swim. You know, it's another indication of how people react under certain circumstances. But there was absolutely no panic whatsoever, and we just waited our turn to get off. We all had life jackets, and I had a life jacket on, and when I got to the rail, where it was my turn, I wasn't going to go down the ropes because it, I couldn't see myself lowering myself down the rope. I was going to jump off. But when I got to the rail, I noticed that blokes had taken their boots off. And they had these boots in pairs, all lined up neatly alongside the rail and in pairs, you know. Our army training still came out. I got to the rail and I jumped off. I don't know how high it was, and I have no idea, but it seemed like an age hitting the water. And all I had on was a pair of underpants and a vest and a watch, which unfortunately wasn't waterproof. I was in the water, I think I was in the water for perhaps an hour, 2 hours. Kept afloat quite easily with the life jacket. But I couldn't swim anywhere because there was nowhere to swim. You're just in the sea. But there's a lot of small craft came out from Singapore to pick us up. And I was picked up by a small naval craft. It was more like a I don't know what the word to call them, like a small, it was a small motor launch. And it could only take so many. There was only perhaps about 20 of us picked up. And we're taken to Singapore and dropped off there. Now, what happened after that was, it's almost a blank. I can't remember what happened as far as getting clothing was concerned. We're obviously clothed. We eventually, as far as I can only suppose that the regiment was kept together, or you went to a particular area where your regiment was, and then we were given rifles. All our equipment, all our anti-tank guns went elsewhere. We found out later that they went to Sumatra and Java and places like that. But we were given rifles, and we had no infantry training at all. From there, we were deployed into various areas on Singapore because the Japanese had come down the mainland and across the Straits of Johor and had landed in Singapore. The whole strategy of the defence of Singapore was proved to be entirely wrong. The defence of Singapore was based on some very, very large guns that were pointing south, because it was thought that no army could come down, could come through the jungles, the jungle of Malaya, but the Japanese did. These guns were fixed guns and they couldn't be turned round. So the army had to go to the north of the island and try and stem the invasion of Singapore, which was absolutely impossible. We eventually got to a situation where the Singapore itself was being bombed, and there's an awful lot of casualties. I don't know how many, but the civilian population were being bombed pretty severely. I was in at one time I remember I was in a I was on an aerodrome where this was I can't remember. But eventually we were told that we were going to have to capitulate.
Do you remember anything about where you were, the accommodation
I just can't. I have no idea. Accommodation as far as houses and that, it was just not, you know, there just wasn't any. You lived rough, you know, you just lived off on the land. But the reason that was given and I quite believe this, that we had to capitulate, was the fact that the Japanese had taken over the reservoirs. And they were going to cut off the water supply to Singapore, which would have meant thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths. So there was no point in fighting. We had nowhere to go. The Japanese had obviously taken over, and our commanding officer, which was a man called Major General Beckwith Smith, he capitulated to the Japanese.
How long after you got to Singapore was this, the capitulation? Can you remember?
It was about 10 days. If I'm not mistaken, we landed on the 5th of February and I was taken prisoner on the 15th. There's one thing, I never fired a shot in anger. I never saw a Japanese until it was all over. We were just, after capitulation, we just sat around waiting to see what was going to happen. And it was only a matter of a day or two before we saw Japanese troops. And that was the first time I saw Japanese. So my immediate thoughts were, what the hell have I been sent here for? More or less, halfway around the world, into a place where it was obvious that at that time that Singapore was going to fall. We just couldn't understand why the 18th Division had been sent to Singapore. There was all sorts of stories that we made up and reasons for it. And I sometimes wonder whether it was because the public in England could be told that there was a certain number of troops on Singapore Island. It was absolutely certain, long before we got to Singapore, that Singapore was going to fall. I'm sure of that. And I have no historical and official knowledge of this, but that was just our opinion about it. And it seemed what a waste that we'd been taken prisoner of war on a far eastern island, which was obviously going to fall.
Did you have any knowledge of the situation in Singapore prior to getting there?
No, none whatsoever. It was only afterwards that we knew that the situation was absolutely ridiculous for us to be there. But we were, and then we were taken prisoner.
Can you describe, or can you remember the process of the Japanese when they first arrived? You said you sat around for a day or two.
Difficult, but I'll try. As far as I can remember, we were, as I say, we just sat around waiting, and the Japanese came and lined us up and told us to march, and we marched from Singapore City, or the outskirts of Singapore City, to a place called Changi, where our regiment was in a place called Roberts Barracks at Changi, and we were there, I can't remember exactly, but we were there quite some time. But life wasn't too bad then. I don't think the Japanese really knew what to do with us. We made our own life. The food wasn't good. The rations weren't good, obviously, but far, far better than what we were going to experience over the next few years.
What were the rations that you were getting at that time?
It was rice. But there were rations of vegetables, and there were small rations of meat. And we, after a while, we used to go on trips to Singapore on lorries and did various jobs in Singapore for the Japanese. One of them was to move whatever was in the warehouses from one place to another or put on lorries. And there was one place in particular, one job in particular that I was on, that I found myself on, was cement. We're moving cement and bags of cement. And in the same warehouse, would you believe, there was some tinned food. Well, the ingenuity of the English soldier very soon found ways and means of that, some of that food being taken out and used for our own benefit.